Hello, I'm Steve Hatton. This is number 0708, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0708. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet cybersecurity expert Sherry Davidoff, who talks about artificial intelligence, some of the pitfalls, and where it can take us in the future.
We're gonna see some uses that are extraordinarily beneficial to humans. For example, we can have artificial intelligence comb through medical records automatically and come up with better predictions, better models for diagnosing your issues and for prescribing drugs and things like that that can help make you better, prescribing treatments. ChatGPT can also handle some of the lower, more entry-level tasks that maybe a lot of humans don't wanna do. Some of your frontier, round-the-clock customer support that really could be handled by a smart chatbot.
Christian Lopez is the author of But Have You Read the Book? It's done in collaboration with Turner Classic Movies and features 52 films and the books they were based on. What was the criteria for picking the 52 films?
So eventually we went back and forth on what was easy for an audience to find the book. Some books were out of print. I had to cut out a few novellas because we wanted actual book length. And eventually we settled on 52 was the number that I was like, you know what, I think I can read through most of these in the time period that I have. And there were a lot of old favorites that I loved, but also new stuff that I hadn't had the opportunity to cross off my to-read list. So this was a good excuse.
Science writer Andrew Bezekas, the night sky guy, is back to talk about, among other things, scientists who are concerned about the amount of space junk that is currently floating around.
This is something that's really becoming ever more critical, is this whole idea of pollution in space. Not just satellites themselves, but the boosters, the rocket systems that come with it, and then retired satellites floating around. And scientists are basically sounding the alarm now that we really need to address this problem now, not just in low Earth orbit, but the Earth's orbit itself.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0708, was Montreal freelance writer Steve Hatton. Thank you very much, Steve, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. The Exmoor Squirrel Project, a conservation endeavor in the United Kingdom aimed at saving the native red squirrel, has proposed that people set live traps for the non-native gray squirrel and that restaurants serve its meat, said the group's manager, Carrie Hosegood. Our woodlands landscape and the biodiversity isn't set up to deal with the behaviors of the gray. I'm sorry, is that her way of saying there goes the neighborhood? Anyway, she goes on to say, we're going to introduce them to restaurants in the Exmoor area because they actually make for good eating. This isn't something that we like to do, just target grays. It's a very serious project. She said the gray squirrels had caused about 40 million pounds worth of damage to trees annually. It would appear that those North American gray squirrels are everywhere.
From the stratosphere to the now and here, from the vaulted blue direct to you, it's Rocky the Flying Squirrel.
Hi there.
I sense a brand new British fast food sensation here. By the way, in connection with this story, I watched a bit of ITV's This Morning, which is on every day in Britain, and they had a segment where a chef was serving up squirrel risotto and buttermilk squirrel, and apparently many people change the channel. Yum.
We have the meats.
You missed it again. Key West, Florida's annual conch shell blowing contest took place on March the 4th with Carol Whiteley of Ontario, Canada, winning the women's division, and Brian Cardis of Macon, Georgia, taking the men's top prize. Entrants of all ages were judged on quality, novelty, duration, and loudness. Michael and Georgianne Wachter of Avon Lake, Ohio, impressed the audience with a shell and vocal duet of Elvis Presley's Hound Dog. Oh, that's enough of that. Getting back to the Canadian, Whiteley said she toots her shell to celebrate sunsets at her riverside home. Oh, the neighbors must love her. Well, here's a heartwarming story that we're only just finding out now. It happened in November. Dr. Adam Bodzin, a surgeon at Jefferson Hospital in downtown Philadelphia, was all scrubbed and his team was ready to do an emergency surgery, a liver transplant. 66-year-old Charles Rowe, who was to get the transplant, was all prepped too, but there was one thing missing, the liver, which was supposed to be there already. They tracked it down. The driver delivering it was stuck in traffic because the Philadelphia Marathon was in progress and the downtown area was jammed. He was just a half mile away. The hospital tried and failed to get police to get to the driver and escort him to the hospital. So Bodzin took matters into his own hands. He put his white lab coat over his scrubs and took off running himself across the course and steering around runners. The way back was more difficult since he was holding a large box, but the transplant went off without a hitch, said Rowe, who has made an excellent recovery. He's a really amazing doctor. He went beyond the call of duty. I guess he has a cape on under that white jacket.
Shh, you weren't supposed to see the cape.
And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the Whiteley County, Kentucky Sheriff's Department had multiple warrants for a woman's arrest and went to a home in Williamsburg to take her into custody. But the people who let them in wouldn't cooperate. The woman was not to be seen, and the adults in the house were close-lipped about where she might be. So a toddler stood up, put his hands on his hips, and stated, "It is good to be honest. We shouldn't lie. She is inside the room next to the bathroom." Sure enough, she was, and 45-year-old Tina Hicks was taken to jail. Out of the mouths of babes. I believe the Indigo Girls said it best in "There's Still My Joy."
One tiny child can change the world.
Yes. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? The successful launch of ChatGPT is pushing big tech, including Microsoft and Google, to accelerate artificial intelligence research. So, what will the applications that ChatGPT and other AI technologies have in our everyday lives? That's a question for Sherry Davidoff, who is a cybersecurity expert and CEO of LMG Security. She joins us via Zoom from Missoula, Montana. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, thank you so much, Peter, for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program with us. As I mentioned on the show last week in jest, I actually typed into ChatGPT the question, "Who is Peter Anthony Holder?" And the response I got back led me to believe that this is probably where George Santos gets his bio information from. I couldn't believe how impressive I was on ChatGPT. None of it true, but impressive.
Well, and the best part is you can say, "Go on," and it will.
So what does this mean for the future? I mean, I'm assuming that where we are right now with ChatGPT, it's in its, shall we say, infancy stage, and it's going to improve. But where is it going, and how will it be an everyday part of our lives?
Well, you're absolutely right that this technology is in its infancy phase, and it has been jump-started. The company behind it, OpenAI, received $1 billion in funding from Microsoft. So that is part of how its development occurred and why we are able to access it today and why it's as good as it is. It is like any tool. You know, a knife can be used for good or for evil. And the same thing is true with ChatGPT, right? And so we're going to see some uses that are extraordinarily beneficial to humans. For example, we can have artificial intelligence comb through medical records automatically and come up with better predictions, better models for diagnosing your issues and for prescribing, you know, drugs and things like that that can help make you better, prescribing treatments. So in that respect, it can really help to benefit us. ChatGPT can also handle some of the lower, more entry-level tasks that maybe a lot of humans don't want to do. Some of your frontier, round-the-clock customer support that really could be handled by a smart chatbot. Or, for example, I do a lot of blogs, and I always have to get research interns to help me do the research and comb Google and comb the internet for facts and then summarize it for me. Now, ChatGPT can analyze that information very quickly, and so it really can help us leapfrog to that next level without needing as much labor, which is great.
What are some of your concerns about where this is going, how it can be used in a bad way or by bad people?
Yeah, so I already heard my first advertisement on the radio encouraging someone to use artificial intelligence to make a fake voice for themselves so that they could pretend to be answering the phone when in reality it was just a robot. And so I think that there are some concerns there about who are we really speaking with? And it also, of course, has the potential to free you from sitting around and answering your phone or answering basic questions. People are already using it to write emails, write letters, write policies. I'm sure like some of the basic requests that attorneys get are going to be reduced. And so we're going to start to see some changes in the types of jobs that are available to people. So folks that are experienced in blog writing or in coming up with policies and things like that, they may find that some of the tasks that they're hired to do on a regular basis are no longer available because artificial intelligence will do it. So that's one concern. Another concern I have as a security professional is that we see a ton of data breaches, right? I mean, Peter, you've probably seen in the news that so-and-so hospital gets hit with ransomware or a public school district gets hit with cyber extortion and all the student information is leaked to the world, right? You've seen those headlines?
Absolutely.
And one of the things that stops that information from being terribly misused is that it takes a lot of time for anybody to go through it, including criminals. Now that we have artificial intelligence in place, and it's only going to get better, it's going to be able to sift through huge volumes of leaked data and make data products out of those, which can then be sold to data brokers or used by nation states against us, or really however the people who get a hold of them would want. And so we are going to have less and less control over leaked information and what happens with it.
You mentioned students earlier, and that's one issue that some people are questioning, the idea of how artificial intelligence will be used by students. I'm old enough to remember back in the day when the world was totally aghast with the idea of bringing calculators into schools. It seems to be similar, but I find it somewhat more nefarious because it's a situation where people aren't necessarily learning. Unlike the math situation, they have to know the rudimentary ideas of math to use a calculator. But this is a different situation where this can write a paper for you, and you don't really need to know literature or composition.
Right, exactly. I mean, I had the same thought as you. I remember the debate when I was a kid about should you have a calculator, should you not have a calculator? You can have one, but only if it's kind of a dumb calculator. And the fact is that those things that I was learning in class, like secant, cosine, sine, I have not needed those as an adult. And if I did, I would be very glad that I had my calculator. I think there's an opportunity for us to think about what are the next level things that we can be teaching children. Okay, you can get someone to research this for you and to succinctly summarize it. Now, how are you going to take it to the next level? Because what I've noticed in what ChatGPT produces is that, number one, it's not always accurate, so you must check it. And number two, and that hopefully will give people critical thinking skills about where do I get my information? You know, that's something we can start prioritizing in our classrooms. How do you vet information? How do you make sure you're using a trusted source and that you don't necessarily trust what ChatGPT or anybody else spits out? And then how do you take it to the next level? What is your own creative spin on this? How are you going to make it different? And I think that is going to be a challenge for teachers, but one that will help us to educate our next generation at an even higher level.
What about those who are really scared about this whole thing and think that, you know, eventually computers will take over?
Well, don't speak badly about our future overlords is what I would recommend. I love ChatGPT and the new, no. I mean, you know, there is a risk. It's not a surprise that those technology leaders are very concerned about this, because there may well come a point where artificial intelligence gets out of control, especially if we give it the ability to actually make decisions in our lives. And so it's very important right now for us to be putting safety mechanisms in place. And that has happened with every single technology that has existed, right? Cars are a great example. Cars did not originally have seat belts. I don't know if you've ever looked at the early history of car safety, but it's hilarious and scary. They actually started putting on the front people scoopers, the idea that if a car hit a person, they could scoop that person out of the way. And that was not very effective. So we really need to probably start doing some research and doing some experiments and understanding what causes AI to get out of control. How can we put some safety mechanisms in place that will enable us to live beneficially with this new technology?
Well, the car analogy is a perfect one, because one of the reasons why some of the odd things that car manufacturers wanted to do was the fact that there was a governmental oversight in the safety of said vehicles. Is that something that is necessary in artificial intelligence, a governmental oversight?
I think it would be a very good idea. And in the security industry, we've really seen an unregulated sector. A good example of this is credit card numbers. Back around the early 2000s, when people really started leveraging credit cards, we saw a ton of credit card fraud. And there were rumblings of the government legislating this and legislating security around it. And the credit card industry said, oh, you don't need to regulate us. We will regulate ourselves. So ultimately, what they did was they formed a consortium. They formed an LLC, really, a for-profit LLC that came up with security standards and pushed those standards, the PCI DSS compliance model, down on people like merchants, on small businesses. And as you saw, for 10, 15 years, we still had rampant fraud, and these businesses paid the price, even though there were better ways to secure it. So I'd love to see us not repeat those mistakes. And again, that's just one example in my line of industry, security and fraud. I think it would be a really good idea for us to have some strong government oversight that's based on, you know, real world science and algorithms, and where they really have the interests of our nation in mind.
So bottom line, if you were to rank it on a scale of 100% and give it either less or more than 50% of a ranking, is artificial intelligence going to be a boon? And I don't mean for the people who use, who create it, but for the people who use it down the road. In other words, is this a major advantage to us, or do you still have some caution?
It's both, like any technology, right? I think we will see some major advantages and also some crises that come out of this as well. And we need to be prepared to respond quickly with an open mind and be very adaptable as new developments come out.
Excellent. Thank you for talking to us. By the way, very quickly, what exactly is LMG Security and what do you guys do?
Thanks for asking. We are a cybersecurity consulting firm. We do penetration testing. So we break into organizations and write reports about it. We also do compliance and cybersecurity training. And our website is lmgsecurity.com. If you'd like to contact me, you can reach me on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and I also have a few books out.
Excellent. Sherry, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
Cybersecurity expert Sherry Davidoff, the CEO of LMG Security and the author or co-author of several books, including Network Forensics, Tracking Hackers Through Cyberspace, also Ransomware and Cyber Extortion, Response and Prevention, and Data Breaches, Crisis and Opportunity. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0708, and you'll find the links to Sherry's site, plus to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order any or all three of those books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on The Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of But Have You Read the Book? Plus, Andrew Vazekas, the Night Sky Guy, is back with his monthly visit, this time talking about, among other things, space junk. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and much more Stuff File news right here, right now. Madison County, Illinois coroner Steve Noone solved a nearly one-year-old mystery on March the 2nd. When he released the results of an autopsy on Richard Mage of Troy, Illinois. Mage's wife, Jennifer, had reported him missing last April after he failed to come home from work. His car, wallet, and keys were at the house, but she couldn't find him. Police searched the house, which they described as a hoarder home, but did not locate him. In fact, they searched twice as Jennifer was also looking for the source of a sewer-like odor in the dwelling. Well, you know where this is going, don't you? Yeah. Well, finally, on December 11th, as Jennifer pulled out Christmas decorations from the concealed storage space, she discovered Richard's mummified body. The coroner ruled that Mage hanged himself and that there was no foul play in his death. Wow. How much of a hoarder was this guy if two police searches couldn't find him? And not to be cruel, but how do you hang yourself in a hoarder's house when everything practically reaches the ceiling? Yeah. A tattoo artist, Dean Gunther of Manchester, United Kingdom, has made one man's body goals come true. He's inked a ripped six-pack on the man's torso, freeing him from eating right and exercising more. Said Gunther of his customer, he decided that by getting a six-pack tattoo, he will always look summer-ready while still being able to enjoy beer and good food. The artistic tat took 2 days to complete. Yeah, that's going to look great when he's old and wrinkled. By the way, I've added a Facebook link so that you can see what the finished body art looks like. It's impressive, but nobody's going to be fooled by it. And your Mates Brewing Company has recalled cans of its watermelon sour beer for excess alcohol. Oh, the irony. The Australian brand said that the beer could pose a risk of illness. It was unintentionally fermented twice, causing it to have a higher alcohol content and carbonation. It's sold in Queensland and online down under. Now, I actually saw these guys on the Australian version of Shark Tank. Yes, I watch everything. They're an amazing success story, even though they didn't get a deal on the show. Hopefully this setback won't set them down under. A Utah man really wanted to get himself arrested. Utah police said 65-year-old Donald Santa Croce was arrested after he allegedly demanded $1 from bank employees and refused to leave. He allegedly entered a Wells Fargo bank in Salt Lake City and presented a note to the bank tellers that read, "Please pardon me for doing this, but this is a robbery. Please give me $1. Thank you." The employees complied and asked Santa Croce to leave, but he refused. He even allegedly told employees to call the police and then sat down and waited for them. Santa Croce allegedly said that if he gets out of jail, he'll rob another bank and ask for more money until he is sent to federal prison. It's not clear why he was so adamant on going to federal prison. He was booked into Salt Lake County Metro Jail on a felony robbery charge, but was released. So, I guess that means we'll be hearing from him again. In China, women modeling lingerie for online retailers violates the country's rules about spreading obscene material. Instead, underwear companies are hiring men to model the clothing, and it's working out better than you might think, said one online commentator. The guy wears it better than the girl. Others argue that the restrictions are depriving women of job opportunities, said one business owner. We don't really have a choice. The designs can't be modeled by our female colleagues, so we will use our male colleagues to model it. Wow, is it me, or does this remind you of the movie Tootsie?
Something more, though.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's your decision, but there's something about it that bothers me. Doesn't it bother you?
I like it.
Exactly. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, 21-year-old Hayato Baba of Narashino, Japan, was taken into custody in March because he allegedly assaulted another man and stole his wallet outside a convenience store, all because the guy was taking too long in the restroom. Baba admitted he punched the victim twice in the face and took the wallet. Wow. When you gotta go, you gotta go. But seriously, does punching somebody help to relieve your bowel issues?
When you have nausea, heartburn, indigestion, upset stomach, diarrhea.
Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Kristen Lopez, who is a film editor at The Wrap, which is one of my favorite Hollywood sources online, has a new book out. It's called But Have You Read the Book? It's a tome that is for both film buffs and literature lovers. It's presented by Turner Classic Movies, and it features 52 movie classics and the literary works that they were based on. Kristen joins us via Zoom from Los Angeles. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
This is a marvelous idea for a book because this is a debate that's been going on for years and years and years. What made you think to write a book about this?
Yeah, the credit partially goes to TCM because this was an idea that they had initiated. And I had always wanted to write a book. I love TCM. And when we had started talking, they said, "You have a master's degree in English. Do you read a lot?" And I had to laugh at that because I do read a lot. But I also do have the tendency to seek out a book if I know it's going to be made into a movie. I cannot wait the year or 2 years it takes to make a film. So I like to be spoiled ahead of time. So it was really a perfect union of an idea that they already had and a writer that was already really into film adaptations.
Well, that's an interesting point you brought up. You say you like to be spoiled ahead of time. Does it spoil a movie for you? Or do you walk into the movie theater with a lot of preconceived notions of how this film is supposed to go?
I do have preconceived notions, mostly as a fan. You know, I love to have my little fan castings and the way I think a scene is going to go, which I always love to have that film lover moment of like, well, that's not the way I would have done it. But I think too, it really does set the tone and it gives me more anticipation in many instances because I still do have to wait in many times to see the finished product. So a lot of times I'll read the book super early in the process, then it takes a year, and then I tend to forget a lot of the smaller elements of a book. So it gives me the best of both worlds, I think, that I can experience the book free of the film. And then by the time I do see the film, I can retain the parts that I liked, maybe the parts that I didn't like, and experience the movie knowing this kind of insider information.
Now, in your book, you go through 52 cinema classics. Was it difficult to break it down to just 52?
The long list that TCM and I, we went back and forth on, initially started with about 85 movies. And I knew that I wanted diversity in terms of genre, in terms of eras, in terms of author, directors. So I knew I had my work cut out for me. I also had a short turnaround, relatively short for writing a book. So I knew I had to pick a lot of movies that either I knew well enough that I wouldn't have to either reread the book very closely or that I knew like the back of my hand. And I wanted everything to be relatively short if I did have to read it all the way through. So eventually we went back and forth on what was easy for an audience to find the book. Some books were out of print. I had to cut out a few novellas because we wanted actual book length. And eventually we settled on 52 was the number that I was like, you know what, I think I can read through most of these in the time period that I have. And there were a lot of old favorites that I loved, but also new stuff that I hadn't had the opportunity to cross off my to-read list. So this was a good excuse.
Did you, in doing the research for the book, did you have any stories dealing with how the book became a film?
Well, in many instances, especially in the studio era, pre-1960s, you had, each studio had readers that would actually go and read all of the popular books and send a outline to the head of the studio saying whether a book was feasible to be made. Nowadays, you don't have that exact same process. So it was really fun to look at certain books and just be like, what is the popularity behind this at the time? Because especially as we get into more modern time periods, there's so much distance between when a book is popular and when the movie comes out that you often are seeing a movie come out maybe 5 years after the book is out. And you're like, nobody cares about this book anymore. But in the studio era, it was so easy to make a movie that you could maybe get a movie out in a year, 6 months sometimes, while a film was still hot. So I think what I loved looking at in terms of the background of like what makes a book popular is like in some instances you have unfilmable books, you know, like your Dunes that are often considered just impossible to adapt. But I think what I loved most was looking back at some of the studio era films, you know, like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes or The Thin Man, and reading those and being like, I can see where this book is so representative of the era it was made. And the film is representative of the era in which it was made.
The reason why I ask that question is because I know that you have a mix of, as you say, current films and older films. And also I noticed there was a kind of a mix between movies that were made from books where the authors were long dead and movies that were made from books where the author is still very alive. And I'm just wondering if you had any background as to how some of those still living authors liked their books being turned into films at the time.
Yeah, in many instances, they didn't like them. In the case of someone like maybe Dashiell Hammett, who did The Thin Man, he worked heavily with W.S. Van Dyke, who was the director on the first two films, I believe. Definitely the first film. And by the time the second and third sequels and those that franchise, which turned out to be a franchise, happened, he had moved on. He couldn't ever recreate Nick and Nora Charles for the page. There's only one Thin Man book. And he really didn't care for how the finished product turned out. Roald Dahl took years to be happy with the film version of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. He didn't like Gene Wilder. He thought the character completely missed the mark of what he had written, and it took him a long time to begrudgingly accept that a generation had loved his movie and loved his book off of the movie that they had seen. Ernest Hemingway is also a really great example. When he wrote To Have and Have Not, which is actually one of his worst books, Howard Hawks, who was a friend of his, and him made a bet that Hawks could turn his worst book into a good film. And Hawks did eventually turn his work into a decent film, the 1940s, To Have and Have Not. But Hemingway was more upset that Hawks made so much money peddling the rights to the book than Hemingway did giving him the rights. So even once they remade the movie again in 1950 as The Breaking Point, he was happier that it was closer to his novel, but he was just still more upset that he did not get rightfully what he felt was his financial compensation.
By the way, To Have and Have Not is a film that I've seen most recently on Turner Classic Movies. Just thought, yes. Toss that in there. We should mention some of the books, some of the movies, rather, that you talk about. There's Children of Men, The Color Purple, Crazy Rich Asians, Dr. No. I could spend all day talking about Dr. No alone. Dune, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Kiss Me Deadly, The Last Picture Show, Little Women, The Princess Bride, The Shining, The Thin Man, True Grit, the list goes on and on, Valley of the Dolls. In doing this, do you have a favorite book? And do you have a favorite movie? And are they one and the same?
Oh, it's tough because I can't say that I read anything or watched anything that I didn't like, you know, which was great. You want that. For me, you know, my favorite book is always Wuthering Heights. That was the book that made me love books. And I do appreciate the movie, but it is not the book. It's very much a 1930s romance. Emily Bronte's novel is far more of a gothic tragedy in many regards, but the book is beautifully written. And my favorite movie, you know, it's actually probably also a fantastic book as well, Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park is often considered, I consider it one of the best adaptations because you can watch the movie and read the book and still get an incredibly fun cinematic experience out of both of them. They're very different in terms of character motivations, but I love the movie as much as I love the book, and that does not always happen.
Well, what was the book, or sorry, what was the movie, I should say, that surprised you the most as compared to the book?
Ooh, you know, I think Dr. No might be a great example. I had never seen a Sean Connery Bond before I embarked on this project. And I read the original novel, and it's kind of silly. It's very silly. And I expected the movie to be kind of boring, very dated, very 1960s. But it is a really great example of how a great screenwriter can take a text and use it as a guide, not a foundation. And in that case, they really did have to do some skewing of Ian Fleming's original novel, which is very silly. The original villain ends up being like killed by bird poop. It's very, very ridiculous in many regards. And the film, I think, does ground an already extravagant book series and an extravagant character in a way that is very fun.
I know the book is just out, but I can only think that this is not where you're going to end, that there'll probably be a second book. Is that a chance?
I would love there to be a second book. It's something that we've definitely talked about different ideas because I think that there's a whole world out there for people that maybe love adaptations or love remakes. You know, I think that what makes movies so fun is that you can really watch one and it opens up this rabbit hole to a lot of different things, whether that's a remake you love that's based on an original classic film that maybe you've never heard of, or a film that you love that is based on this book that you didn't even know existed up until a few minutes ago. So I would love more. I know that I couldn't include a lot of the adaptations I wanted to. So yeah, if TCM gave me the high sign to do more books, I would love to do them.
Do you ever worry that you're going to just be feeding into the world of the snobs out there? You know, the people who always say, well, if you enjoyed the movie, you have to read the book.
I think there's room for everybody. You know, and that was a big thing when I wrote the book. I think one of the criticisms I've heard is that I'm not critical enough of the books that I included. And that's the thing. I didn't want to include books that I didn't love or, you know, movies that I didn't love, because I think that there's a desire to hate watch stuff or hate read things. And I'm just not about that. Life is too short to spend time reading or watching things you are not into. So I definitely do think that, you know, if you're a person that says, well, the book is better, that's great, but not every book is perfect, nor is every movie. And I think the 52 books that I included in this tome really do show the litany, the broad spectrum of adaptation, the good, the bad, and somewhere in between, because I think that you can love either or, and it's that perfect union sometimes, that makes for real magic.
Well, it's an excellent topic for a book. Congratulations on having put out But Have You Read the Book? Thank you very much, Kristen, for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much.
Kristen Lopez, author of But Have You Read the Book? You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0708, and you'll find the links to Kristen's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. And Patreon subscribers, you can hear more of Kristen with our post-interview chat. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Hi, I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I'm the host of a new weekly podcast called Business Beyond Bizarre. What exactly is Business Beyond Bizarre?
A podcast of the slightly unusual.
Yeah, like she said. To be more specific, it's a show that features folks who have slightly quirky hobbies or businesses. It's a chance to meet some people who think outside the box and, metaphorically speaking, are off the beaten path. You'll meet folks like the creators of the fart spray called Liquid Ass, the woman who invented goat yoga, father and son undertakers who have perfected how to save your tattoos after you die, the founder of the religion Jediism, plus why you should be drinking gin made from elephant dung.
Business Beyond Bizarre.
Oh, there's a lot more where these came from. Give us a listen. Who knows? This show might just spark you to find your own slightly bizarre path.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy, is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky, and also National Geographic's Stargazer's Atlas, the ultimate guide to the night sky. And Andrew, here's a topic that we've touched on before, space debris. And apparently it's in the news again.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's really becoming ever more critical, is this whole idea of pollution in space, that humans putting out more and more stuff into space, assets there, and like not just satellites themselves, but the boosters, the rocket systems that come with it, and then, you know, retired satellites floating around. So there's a lot out there, and scientists are basically sounding the alarm now that we really need to address this problem now, not just in low Earth orbit, but the Earth's orbit itself. There seems to be more and more debris left behind in the same orbit that Earth has around the sun. So that Earth's orbit seems to be more and more cluttered with things that, so some of these boosters and other bits and pieces of things that are left behind, parts of spacecrafts and giant bus-sized spacecrafts themselves, just floating around in the same orbit as the Earth. And this is something that needs to be addressed, they feel, soon, because there's on the horizon many more, like orders of magnitude more satellites that will be put into place in and around Earth and the lunar orbit. We're planning on exploring the moon. So there's more assets that will be in and around the moon as well. So this needs to be taken care of. And what they're suggesting is that we use the same paradigm as looking at how we look at the seas, the oceans as well, and how we mitigate the pollution of the oceans as well, and looking at that as a model, perhaps the protection of how we protect our oceans and protecting this other natural resource, which is space.
Now, I think there's an even greater danger, because while pollution in the seas is a very, very important issue, and Lord knows just with major world wars, there's a lot of stuff down there from battle alone, never mind all the other junk that we're putting down there. While it may be causing eco damage, which, well, not may, it definitely is causing some sort of eco damage, it's not posting a danger to anybody who's on the sea, as opposed to in space. Those things are just flying around waiting to hit something.
Exactly. Yeah. And the more of these things that are in space, the more chances there are of collisions. I mean, one of these scenarios, nightmare scenarios, if you may remember, played out in that movie with Sandra Bullock called Gravity, where you had this chain reaction of satellites hitting each other, causing huge clouds of metallic shrapnel that just polluted entire orbits. And any other satellite that, you know, was in the same orbit would be smashed to smithereens, basically exploding into its own shrapnel cloud. So you have this chain reaction potential. And, it, you know, that's what played out in this Hollywood movie. But it's the same kind of really, you know, these dangers can in reality play out. And basically the idea is to prevent these kind of potential tragedies in space, which many scientists and folks in the space community at large are thinking this is a commons place. This is for all of humanity, you know, to benefit all of humanity. So, you know, there are these rogue actors, you know, nations like China and Russia that are kind of using space with impunity without really even, you know, consideration to other nations and the safety. So there's this collective call that scientists are putting out there that should be put out to develop some kind of legally binding agreements that nations across the world would be held accountable to.
Now, this story has come out in the news because there was a recent letter that was written. Who was the letter written by, and who was it written for?
Yeah, I mean, these are this was basically put out by scientists themselves and engineers. It's a collective of people, stakeholders, basically, who work in this field, who are realizing that there's this Wild West out there, and it's really for nations' leaders. It's for policymakers, particularly governments, that really need to take charge of making sure of protecting this environment. Just as we protect the seas and other natural environments on Earth, we need to do the same for space. And as you had mentioned, Peter, I mean, it's even more, you know, I think timely, because everyone is just going into space unlike ever before. It's kind of like the price of democratizing the access of space. There needs to, you know, it behooves nations to really then be a curator of, a protector of this precious resource.
Let's be honest, we have a hard time getting people generally to speak about things like climate change, protecting the environment, on this very planet. It seems to be a situation that a lot of times falls on deaf ears. So how can we expect to go beyond and try to protect the environment around our planet beyond the surface when we can't necessarily take care of the surface?
That's exactly the challenge. I mean, how can we do that? If we have issues on our own planet, how are we going to do that and elsewhere? And, you know, I'm hoping that it's not some tragedy that would befall a mission that, you know, obviously a human-rated mission, not a robotic, unmanned satellites, but it may take that for actions to happen, you know, some kind of tragedy. I mean, you look at the oceans and things, what brings attention to the general public to take a stance? It's usually like an oil rig disaster, right? Or you know, a tanker collides or breaks open and, you know, millions of barrels of oil pollute, the Gulf of Mexico. We've seen these kind of things play out time and again, and it's usually in the aftermath and the cleanup of that is when things happen. Unfortunately, in space, we're still learning and getting our space legs, so to speak, and understanding what the ramifications are of these kind of potential tragedies. I don't even know if we can we can deal. How are we going to deal with it? Once you have that kind of shrapnel clouds, for instance, happening, polluting orbits, we may be limiting our access to space if we don't act.
Well, speaking of limiting our access to space, isn't the Hubble telescope being affected by the very debris that we are now talking about?
Absolutely. This is something, really, it's incredible. I mean, the stories just keep on coming from what our humans' effects in space. And, you know, when we talked about the Hubble Space Telescope, that's been coined as the discovery machine for astronomy. I mean, it goes back for three decades now, and it's practically rewritten our textbook of our knowledge of astronomy and the universe at large. And now it seems that the group of astronomers have ringing the alarm bell that even the Hubble can't escape the satellite problem. And when I'm talking about the satellite problem, it's like Starlink and other internet satellite constellations that are being put up. Like SpaceX has put up, you know, over 2,000 satellites, working satellites in low Earth orbit to kind of give internet access globally to remote regions, high-speed internet. There's plans for having, you know, eventually, right now we're looking at over 100,000 of these internet satellites being put up by multiple telecommunication companies around the world. Major players in China, in Europe, and North America, we're talking about mostly, are putting up these assets. And with this growing number of artificial satellites that are currently planned, it turns out that astronomers have found that a fraction of the Hubble Space Telescope's images have been crossed by satellites. And this number of satellites photobombing Hubble images has increased over the last decade, obviously, because there's more satellites. Also, Hubble telescope has slowly decaying in its orbit. So it's decayed about 50 kilometers in the last decade or so, meaning it's lower, closer. It's a natural event of the satellite. And of course, that means more satellites above it are creeping into the picture. And in the next decade, they're calling that this will need close study and monitoring. So there's definitely this impact of satellite trails on Hubble observations. And this is really alarming scientists because they're going, it's not just the Hubble, you know, it's all these ground-based observatories, multi-billion-dollar facilities that astronomers use may be seriously affected in the coming decade by these huge constellation of satellites.
The satellites up there are starting to sound a little bit like watching LA traffic.
Yeah, I mean, and the question, you know, again becomes, once you park these satellites, there's a limited amount of parking space up there around the Earth. Once you've got 100,000 satellites in the next decade up there, where is there going to be a safe space left for not just Hubble, but any other satellite?
100,000 satellites. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, man is expecting to explore other realms, be it the moon or beyond. How do you even get through the ring of satellites in a launch?
Exactly. I mean, already, there is about 4,000 operational satellites right now in space. And guess what? Half of those are made up by Starlink satellites from SpaceX.
Wow. Wow. The guy who owns Twitter. Anyway.
studies that are now.
Yeah. We are just about out of time once again, which means we don't get a chance to talk about some of the other issues we wanted to talk about, like Chinese spacecraft inspecting U.S. satellites. Also with China, the fact that their rover on Mars seems to be dead. And time zones on the moon. Those are things we never got a chance to discuss. You want to go over to Patreon and talk about those things?
You bet. Let's do it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Andrew.
You bet. Clear skies.
Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky, and also the new National Geographic Stargazer's Atlas, The Ultimate Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0708, and you can find links to Andrew's site to get your own personal autographed copy. And Patreon subscribers, you can hear more of Andrew as a Patreon reward extra, where we'll discuss China's spy satellites spying on other satellites, China's dead rover on Mars, and what time is it on the moon, and more. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A man who attempted to rob a teenager at knife point was unaware it was his own son. The 45-year-old pounced at an ATM in Glasgow's Cranhill area last November. The 17-year-old victim had used the cash machine close to his home to withdraw £10. He saw a hooded man dressed in dark clothing with a snood over his face lurking nearby. The accused pinned the teen up against the wall by the neck. The boy felt a large kitchen knife pressed against his face. Court records state that the accused said, "Give me it! Give me it now!" The victim instantly identified his dad from his voice and eyes. The stunned boy said, "Are you serious? Do you know who this is?" The attacker replied, "I don't give a bleep who it is." The victim pulled down the snood, revealing his dad's face, and said, "What are you doing?" The man responded, "I'm sorry, I'm desperate." His son fled the scene and told his grandmother of his ordeal before police were alerted. The robber was later arrested at his home and initially denied being the culprit, but he later stated, "I didn't know it was him at the cash machine. I done it. I will do the time for that." Of course he will. He pleaded guilty to a charge of attempting to rob the victim. Edward Gilroy, the defense lawyer, told the court, "His mother, brother, and son are all extremely angry at him." You figure? Father of the Year has been sentenced to 26 months behind bars. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're planning to rob someone at an ATM, would you not check to see if it is someone you know, like your own son? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0708. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0708. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com, truetalkradio.com, over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, KZZHLPFM in Eureka, California, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, Local 107.3 FM in St. John, CHSR in Fredericton, and also streaming on just about any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this scientific quandary. If, as Einstein said, space and time are the same, then can you be 5 miles late?